It regurgitates long-held logging industry priorities to reshape environmental laws on forest service land and allow profit, not science, to dictate forest management decisions. Yes, we need good faith forest management efforts to prevent wildfires, but not environmental rollbacks that allow for logging and other ecologically damaging activities that would worsen, not reduce, the risk of destructive wildfires.
I agree with that guy. Congressman Don Beyer, Democrat of Virginia.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Go get him, Don.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
I'll try to help.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
Least I could do.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., elsewhere in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN, up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIB, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Richmond, Virginia's WRWK, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet, on the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and exhausted, if swell, fellow from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. We will get to some important stuff in a moment. And hi, Dizzy Doyne.
Hi. It's all important, but yes.
Well, you know, some is more important than others. And we will have a guest joining us for, in fact, some important stuff today to discuss some of that. But after we got off the air on Tuesday, I started receiving alerts on my iPhone Des from various news outlets about the return of the mission to retrieve the astronauts Suni Williams and Butch Wilmore from the space station, where they had been largely stranded for 9 months.
Yeah.
After a Gilligan's Island mission that was only supposed to be a 3-hour tour or something like that.
Yeah.
8 days. But due to a failure in their Boeing return capsule, they had to wait to hitch a ride on a different vessel, one launched by Elon Musk's SpaceX company, before finally returning home to a successful splashdown on Tuesday. But when I saw the alerts coming in about that, I kind of had to smile, because it quickly became clear there was going to be a problem for corporate media in reporting it. I don't know if you noticed this or not. But the first alert that I noticed was Washington Post, which read, quote, "Breaking news. NASA astronauts who were stuck in space for 9 months safely splashed down in Gulf of Mexico."
Uh-oh.
Right? So I guess they'll be banned from official White House events, like AP was for referring to the Gulf of Mexico, right? How did the other ones handle it? Well, CNN seems to have sidestepped the problem with the White House by reporting in their alert, quote, "Breaking news, SpaceX craft carrying NASA's Butch Wilmore and Suni Williams splashes down off the coast of Florida."
Ah, clever.
See what they did there?
Yeah.
Most of the outlets basically did the same thing to avoid references to the Gulf of Mexico or Donald Trump's Gulf of America at all in their actual stories covering the astronauts and their successful splashdown return. New York Times handled it this way. Suni Williams and Butch Wilmore splashed down in calm azure waters. Is that how you say it?
Azure
waters off the coast of the Florida Panhandle. And then later they said splashdown off Florida's Gulf Coast on Tuesday. Well done, New York Times. AP, which had the temerity to start all of this by simply noting in their international style guide that they would still be referring to it as the Gulf of Mexico because it's in international waters that border other countries, though they said they would recognize Trump's proclamation that it shall be known as the Gulf of America. In the alert they sent out, they wrote, "Breaking news, astronauts Suni Williams and Butch Wilmore return to Earth after 9 months stuck in space with a SpaceX splashdown." No indication of where exactly. But in their story, as promised, they referred to the actual name of the Gulf, writing, quote, "Their SpaceX capsule parachuted into the Gulf of Mexico in the early evening, just hours after departing the International Space Station." Later in the article, at the very end, they reference, quote, "After returning in the Gulf, Trump in January signed an executive order renaming the body of water Gulf of America. Wilmore and Williams will have to wait until they're off the SpaceX recovery ship and flown to Houston before reuniting with their loved ones." And matter of fact, I think of all of this articles that I read on this, I think AP was the only one who actually directly mentioned Gulf of America.
AP is brave.
NBC News used a similar phrasing in their alert. They said, "Watch live. NASA astronauts splash down off Florida after 9 months in space." In the actual story, however, they referred to the splashdown in the Gulf of Mexico, though they also cited a social media statement from the White House, which read, quote, "Promise made, promise kept. President Trump pledged to rescue the astronauts stranded in space for 9 months," like he did it himself. "Today, they splashed down in the Gulf of America, thanks to Elon Musk, SpaceX, and NASA." That was the White House commenting on it. But as NBC quickly noted, that claim is actually misleading. Quote, "NASA had planned since August of last year to bring Williams and Wilmore home in a SpaceX capsule, and today's return flight was the culmination of that effort. The decision was made during the Biden administration," they point out, which the White House did not bother to. And I don't know how many others noted that, but I know Donald Trump has been pretending like he personally went up and got the people off the thing, or at the very least came up with this plan. Here's an idea. Let's have Elon Musk and his SpaceX go get them. Like, he came up with that. It was Joe Biden who came up with that last year.
And we should also point out, Elon Musk has been kind of lying about that as well. This was all, as you say, planned well in advance. And it wasn't because Biden was being incompetent or leaving them there. It's because that's how the scheduling worked out.
It takes that long.
Yeah.
Oh, what a tangled web. Though I got to say, I did enjoy watching the various outlets attempting to try to tiptoe around calling it the Gulf of America, which is dumb, or the Gulf of Mexico, which is accurate, but might tick off Trump and get them, like AP, blocked from coverage of events at the White House and on Air Force One by our man-baby wannabe dictator president. Speaking of, on our previous broadcast, we covered a whole bunch of man-baby dictators' recent losses in federal court on a whole bunch of stuff, including at least one court loss for him, his lawless invocation of the Alien Enemies Act of 1798 to simply be allowed to disappear hundreds of Venezuelan immigrants to a gulag in El Salvador without any due process at all, which his Justice Department still seems to be ignoring, to the chagrin of the chief judge of the U.S. District Court in D.C., Judge James Boasberg. That showdown and potential constitutional crisis continues as the judge has ordered the DOJ to produce sealed documents documenting the migrant flights out of the country, when they left, etc., that because they seem to have been carried out in direct contradiction of the judge's order to turn around the planes and bring the men back to the U.S. But no sooner did we get off air after covering that and some of the other court losses for Trump on Tuesday than Trump lost another big case in the lower courts. Federal judge blocked enforcement of Donald Trump's executive order banning transgender people from military service on Tuesday, the latest in a string of legal setbacks for his sweeping agenda, reports AP. U.S. District Judge Anna Reyes in Washington, D.C., ruled that Trump's order to exclude transgender troops from military service likely violates their constitutional rights. Reyes, who was nominated by President Joe Biden, delayed her order until Friday in order to give the administration time to appeal. Quote, "The court knows that this opinion will lead to heated public debate and appeals. In a healthy democracy, both are positive outcomes," she wrote. "We should all agree, however, that every person who has answered the call to serve deserves our gratitude and respect." Army Reserve's Second Lieutenant Nicholas Talbot, one of the 14 transgender active duty service members named as plaintiffs in this particular lawsuit, said he was holding his breath as he waited to find out if he would be separated from the military next week. Quote, "This is such a sigh of relief," he said. "This is all I've ever wanted to do. This is my dream job, and I finally have it. And I was so terrified that I was about to lose it." Trump's deputy chief of staff, Stephen Miller, posted about the ruling on social media, writing snidely, "District court judges have now decided they are in command of the armed forces. Is there no end to this madness?" Well, they're not in command of the armed forces, Steve, but they are the ones who are in command of making sure that those in the armed forces and all the rest of us enjoy constitutional protections that are available still, at least as of now, to everyone in the United States. Yes, Stephen, even people who are not pals of Donald Trump's. The ruling comes in response to a January 27 executive order signed by Trump that claims the sexual identity of transgender service members, quote, "conflicts with a soldier's commitment to an honorable, truthful, and disciplined lifestyle, even in one's personal life." And Trump went on, "is harmful to military readiness." But if anyone cares about honorable, truthful, and disciplined lifestyles, even in one's personal life, it would be the commander-in-chief, Donald Trump, who owes about $100 million to writer E. Jean Carroll after being found liable for sexually abusing her and lying about her in what a judge described as the common definition of rape. Add to that his 34 convictions for massive fraud and more related to hush money payments to a porn star to help him cheat to win the 2016 presidential election. Speaking of honorable, truthful, and disciplined lifestyles, even in one's personal life. Plaintiffs' attorneys contend that Trump's order violates transgender people's rights to equal protection under the Fifth Amendment. For now, the judge, Judge Reyes, said she did not take lightly her decision to issue an injunction blocking Trump's order, noting that, quote, "judicial overreach is no less pernicious than executive overreach." But, she said, it was also the responsibility of each branch of government to provide checks and balances for the others. Well, there's an idea. And the court, quote, "therefore must act to uphold the equal protection rights that the military defends every day," unquote. The plaintiffs who sued to block Trump's order include an Army Reserve's platoon leader from Pennsylvania, an Army major who was awarded a Bronze Star for service in Afghanistan, and a Sailor of the Year Award winner serving in the Navy. All those people were going to be thrown out of the military.
Such waste of taxpayer dollars to train those people and have them work and work in such stellar capacity and then just throw them out. That's just ridiculous.
The quote, "the cruel irony is that thousands of transgender service members have sacrificed, some risking their lives to ensure for others the very equal protection rights that the military ban seeks to deny them," the judge wrote. Yet, These accomplished service members are now subject to an order that says they must be separated from the military based on a characteristic that has no bearing on their proven ability to do the job, according to the plaintiff's attorneys. This is a stark and reckless reversal of policy that denigrates honorable transgender service members, disrupts unit cohesion, and weakens our military. Federal judges in Seattle and Baltimore separately paused Trump's executive order halting federal support for gender-affirming care for transgender youth under 19. Last month, the judge blocked prison officials from transferring three incarcerated transgender women to men's facilities and terminating their access to hormone therapy under yet another Trump order. Talbot, the 31-year-old Army Reserve second lieutenant, in one of the case's 14 plaintiffs, enlisted in March of 2024 as an openly trans person after fighting for roughly 9 years to join the service. He said his fellow soldiers gave him some good-natured flack for being so much older than other recruits, but never treated him differently for being trans. Talbot anticipates that his colleagues will be, quote, pretty excited that I got to stay, adding, quote, now I can go back to focusing on what's really important, which is the mission. That was Second Lieutenant Talbot, a platoon leader for a military policing unit. Well, at least for now, he will be able to. Do you think Trump is going to stop fighting this order ever? TPM's David Kurtz, in his morning memo column, characterized all of the court losses for Trump in a single day on Tuesday as, quote, the day the federal courts stood tall. The showdown, he writes, between President Trump and the federal judiciary came to a head on Tuesday in a more dramatic and direct way than morning memo had anticipated, with Trump dangerously but also absurdly calling for the impeachment of the federal judge who ruled against him in the Alien Enemies Act case. Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts stirred from his torpor long enough to issue a rare rebuke of the president. Roberts' decision to come to the defense of district judges who have been on the front lines of this constitutional battle keeps them from being marooned on an island while their decisions wind their way up through the lengthy appeals process. Harvard Law professor Jack Goldsmith observed, quote, the Chief Justice's statement now renders the Trump confrontation one with the entire federal judiciary and not just the lower federal courts. What followed over the course of the day was a series of significant court rulings against the Trump administration. While the compressed timing of the rulings was mostly coincidental, the thrust of the decisions all pointed in the same direction. 2 months into his second term, President Trump has wildly exceeded his constitutional authority on numerous fronts. Says Kurtz, I wish I could say that the combination of the Chief Justice's rebuke and the multiple legal setbacks suggests that the federal judiciary is girding for a fight over the rule of law and its own constitutional powers. He says, I hope that's the case. I want that to be the case. But we need to see appeals courts and the high court itself weighing in on the substance of these cases in the weeks and months to come, before we can assess whether the judicial branch will hold the line. There is no doubt, he says, that Trump is itching to co-opt the judiciary. That, of course, just as we discussed yesterday, he's already commandeered largely the entire executive branch, where he thinks he is the supreme ruler even of independent agencies housed in the executive branch. He already owns both chambers of Congress thanks to completely pliant Republican Party officials in both chambers and a Democratic Party that hasn't yet figured out how to muster a fight. So, with those two branches under his belt, he is now gunning for full control of the judiciary as well, you know, as dictators do. Notes Kurtz, it bears repeating that the courts alone cannot save us from autocracy. But losing the courts entirely would be a devastating blow that would make additional areas of American public and private life vulnerable to Trump's rampage and would immeasurably add to the future workload of rebuilding what Trump has broken. For one day, though, he notes, the judicial branch stood tall. And there was yet another loss for Donald Trump in court on Tuesday that came in late. I'll get to that momentarily with my guest. But there were a few comments on yesterday's program highlighting the courts largely holding against the rampant lawlessness of Donald Trump and Elon Musk, at least for now, that I sort of wanted to respond to quickly here before we get to a break. Our friend Susan replied to our posting of yesterday's show over on Facebook to say, "And yet they are ignoring the court orders and everyone is talking about it with their hair on fire, but no one is actually doing anything. Why aren't the U.S. Marshals picking up Musk and his hackers and putting them in jail for contempt of court? What good is a judge's order if there's no consequences for ignoring it? It becomes useless." Good question, Susan. Here's my answer. For one, these fights are hardly over. And there is, for the moment, actually no contempt of court finding by any of the judges overseeing these cases. Now, when they do, if they are if people who are found in contempt are actually ordered jail time and they do not report for that jail time when ordered, well, then the question can be properly raised about the U.S. Marshals, who may or may not at that time respond in such a case. We'll see. Since I believe, in fact, they are part of the Justice Department, they may find themselves in a difficult case where they would have to detain someone else in the Justice Department under such a contempt order. We will see. But we are not there yet. So having U.S. Marshals show up to just do something, well, that would not be appropriate, much less lawful at this time, even if it would, you know, probably be very satisfying to watch. SF Mikey responds similarly over on our Daily Coast posting of yesterday's program to say Trump's swinging for the fences now that he's got a second term, full-on dictatorship, executive orders issued like royal decrees. Is there anything to stop him and his evildoers? I don't think so. Trump does nothing to unite the country. Pathetically, he is only grasping for personal gain. Meanwhile, I think Trump is leading the country to political violence. Maybe. I hope not, but maybe. We've already seen some of that violence, at least toward property, if thankfully not yet people, with the torching of Tesla cars, for example, at dealerships around the country in recent days. Alan Grant on Blue Sky, where you can find me at the Brad blog, noted in response to my posting of a link to yesterday's show there, quote, "While it is still pleasant to listen to your overview, the 249-year experiment is over. Schumer enabled the passage of the Enabling Act, and the courts are being ignored. Only a military countercoup will save democracy in the U.S., United States of America." My response to Alan there, you may be right that only a military countercoup will save democracy at some point, but I disagree that the experiment is over. You give up pretty easily, it seems, I snarked in response. I need to sort of gently edit the back and forth thereafter between me and Alan for FCC Radio. But he replied, "Come on, Brad, I never give up easily. But those around me who think this is not the crisis that it is are full of self-delusion. We are screwed. The military coup thing is all of it. Look at what is happening and tell me things are normal. Military coup or screwedness constitutionally," he says. My Blue Sky reply, "Crisis, yes. Screwed, not yet anyway. Normal, absolutely not." So I do understand. I understand the drive by many folks to sort of throw up their hands, say that we're screwed. There's nothing possible that can be done. It's all over. The only thing that can save us is a military coup. And I agree that that could end up being the case at some point. Yes, this is not normal. Yes, this is not good. And it could end up coming to that. But for now, in fact, I think there are a lot of people doing something. There are a lot of folks fighting this attempted constitutional coup by executive in court. And a lot of people winning smaller victories, hopefully leading to larger ones. I certainly understand, however, the inclination to see things as if there is no way out. That may end up being true at some point, but it seems like no way to live one's life until we get there. So if there is anything that can be done, in my case, often just helping you and me to understand what is going on a daily basis, I think we all must do it. Because if everything is over, what's the point of even getting up each day, much less going on the air? And by the way, giving up, saying it's all over, that just makes things easier for the bad guys to make things even worse for everyone else. So I'm not going to live that way, at least as far as I can help it, at least for now, no matter how exhausting and, yes, disheartening things can be each day, and in fact are on many days. But doing nothing and giving up and throwing in the towel, to me, it's not an option. As welcoming as I admit, that sort of feels like some days. But then things only get worse for all of us and for our sons and daughters and our grandchildren and generations to come, not to mention our planet and civilization itself. As I see it, the stakes are too high for that. Period. Now, of course, I welcome your thoughts on all of this via comments at bradblog.com or anywhere that we post the show. I try to read all of the comments, or you can email me via bradcast@bradblog.com with your thoughts. Take a breather if you gotta. I understand. I get it. Come back motivated, but find something that you can do, even in the smallest way, in your hometown, among your family or your friends, to help make things better. That is our job. And in fact, your energy doing so may be contagious. And it may be all that we've got to go on right now. But throwing up your hands and saying, oh, well, that's it. It's over. We're screwed. Like I say, I just don't see that as a healthy way to live, in my opinion. And it's a way that helps nobody feel good. It does nobody any good. At least if you can help it. All right, speaking of civilization and the planet, another court win for the planet and a loss for the Trump administration's EPA. That's next. And another apparent setback for the planet, yes, via executive order. All of that is next, along with my guest, Matt Sadler, from the Center for Economic and Policy Research. That's straight ahead on the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire.
Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com here in fire-prone Southern California. We will get to some of that momentarily, but the Trump administration's seemingly lawless effort to claw back Biden-era EPA grants was tested in open court last week. And the U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan was, as TPM's David Kurtz noted near week's end, having none of it. The case is a civil lawsuit brought by one of the grant recipients seeking to unfreeze monies that it was due, money that appears to be part of grants issued by the Biden administration as part of the Inflation Reduction Act's landmark climate initiatives. It was issued near the end of its term last year, and the Trump administration has frozen those funds. The case doesn't directly touch on the Trump DOJ's baseless effort to use the criminal process to try and freeze some $20 billion in funds that was given to Citibank to manage payments to the grantees in what is called a green bank. Trump's DOJ has been attempting to intimidate the bank holding that money, as well as the grant recipients, in an effort to claw the money back entirely from them. Those corrupt efforts by D.C. U.S. Attorney Ed Martin, you'll recall, led to the forced resignation last week of a senior prosecutor at DOJ who refused to go along with the scheme, saying there was no evidence of criminal wrongdoing that would allow the DOJ to take that money back. She resigned last week rather than sign on to what she described as an unlawful order to take the funds back from the bank. So this case before Judge Chutkan isn't directly about that criminal order, but rather several of the grantees who sued because they have yet to receive the grant monies that they are due. But even in the confines of the civil case, Judge Chutkan said that the government needed to prove some basis for terminating the legally authorized and mandated grant program altogether, as Trump's new EPA administrator is now attempting to do. Said the judge last week during a hearing, quote, "Can you proffer any evidence that the grant was illegal or evidence of abuse or fraud or bribery, that any of that was improperly or unlawfully done, other than the fact that Mr. Zeldin doesn't like it?" she asked the DOJ attorney. Lee Zeldin being the head of Trump's EPA. The DOJ attorneys merely referred back to the letter notifying the grantee that the grant was being canceled, but was unable to offer evidence that the grant was improperly or unlawfully carried out. Judge Chutkan, clearly frustrated with the government attorney, said, quote, "I can cite cases all day, but you have to have some kind of evidence or proffer to back it up." The government attorney replied, "I think that the government has the right to decide who it wants to contract with and when it no longer wants to contract," he said. "Absolutely, absolutely," replied Judge Chutkan in response, adding, quote, "That's not what's at issue here. The government did decide who it wanted to contract with. A new administration came in, didn't like that contract anymore. That's what new administrations do, but there are procedures that have to be followed, and it doesn't appear, at least on the record before me, that these procedures have been followed." That was last week. This week, on Tuesday, the judge restored the bulk of the grants that Trump's EPA had tried to cancel. As Washington Post reported late last night, in yet another apparent loss in court for the Trump administration, at least for now at the lower U.S. District Court level, a federal judge on Tuesday temporarily barred President Donald Trump's Environmental Protection Agency from clawing back at least $14 billion in grants issued by the Biden administration for climate and clean energy projects, saying the EPA had not put forward, quote, "credible evidence of fraud or abuse." U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan ruled that the EPA's sudden mid-February asset freeze and March 11 termination of legally awarded grants came without a legally required explanation to three coalitions of grant recipients. The group said the sudden cutoff of funds approved by Congress appeared to be arbitrary, capricious, or in violation of federal law and regulations. Climate United Fund, Coalition for Green Capital, and Power Forward Communities, which received $7 billion, $5 billion, and $2 billion, respectively, are among eight recipients awarded more than $20 billion under the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, a program established in President Joe Biden's signature 2022 climate law, more commonly known as the Green Bank. In a 23-page opinion, Chutkan said the EPA's actions raised, quote, "serious due process concerns." Sound familiar? And she issued a temporary restraining order barring the grant cutoffs, at least for now. Chutkin did not release the funds to the groups, but ordered that the money be held in their accounts at Citibank and not clawed back or reused for any other purpose by the EPA while the case moves forward. While the agency voiced concerns regarding program integrity, programmatic fraud, waste and abuse, and the, quote, absence of adequate oversight, Chutkin wrote, vague and unsubstantiated assertions of fraud are insufficient. The government can't just void contracts and void agreements and terminate things without following its own regulation, the judge said. In a statement posted on Elon Musk's social media site, EPA Administrator Zeldin repeated allegations that the terminated grants were, quote, riddled with self-dealing and wasteful spending, though as his attorneys were unable to do in court as well, he cited none of that before adding, quote, I will not rest until these hard-earned taxpayer dollars are returned to the U.S. Treasury. That fight will continue, obviously, even as the administration loses yet another round in court. Obscured somehow in that legal fight and by many of the other legal battles that we've been reporting on this week is the fact that what the Trump administration and its tool at the EPA, Administrator Lee Zeldin, is doing and its new Interior Department Secretary Doug Burgum are doing is an effort to not only dismantle President Biden's landmark climate policies, but dismantle the climate and the environment itself. The administration has issued a series of harmful edicts that undermine the fight against our climate crisis. One of them, for example, we referenced very quickly in a Green News report recently last week, but we haven't had the time to return to it until now. And some of these, I think, do need to sort of be lifted above the incoming fire hose of news elsewhere because they are critical, but underreported, I think. As part of the Center for Economic Policy Research, or CPR's, new series called Expose the Heist, Power and Policy in Unprecedented Times, Matt Sedlar wrote yesterday, at the beginning of March, Donald Trump signed an executive order requesting the Bureau of Land Management and the U.S. Forest Service to issue guidance on boosting timber production. The order, titled Immediate Expansion of American Timber Production, mirrors administration officials' perspective that public lands are, quote, assets that can be used to generate more revenue. Or, as Elon Musk recently put it, quote, I think logically we should privatize anything that can reasonably be privatized. Really? How much of the nation's forests, then, should be privatized for profit to satisfy the world's, at least for now, wealthiest man? The order, according to the White House, would rapidly and massively expand timber production on federal lands and, they claim, improve forest management and avoid wildfires in the bargain. Joining us now to discuss that and related matters is Matt Sedlar, a sociologist and climate analyst for the Nonprofit Center for Economic and Policy Research, where he focuses on climate resilience and adaptation. His work has appeared in the LA Times, The Hill, and elsewhere. He also hosts a monthly podcast called Sociology Ruins Everything. Matt Sedlar, welcome to the broadcast, which, by the way, you are also free to ruin if you like.
Thanks for having me.
So how much of our nation's previously protected national forests is Donald Trump hoping to sort of put up for sale here? Why is he doing it? And why is he actually, I guess he says he's doing it for some reason, but why is he actually doing it, at least as you see it?
Yeah, well, it's hard to know how much of it he's willing to put up for privatization. Mm-hmm. As you know, every state is a patchwork of federal, state, local lands, tribal lands. And in California, it's about something like almost 50% of the forests are managed by the U.S. Forest Service. Mm-hmm. So it's a good portion of California, which is very concerning, obviously.
And it's not just California, obviously. It's the entire nation. I don't want people to think, you know, we broadcast out of California, but I don't want people to think that this is a California story only, because it's really national forests everywhere. Now, why does he claim he's doing it?
So this isn't the first time that something like this has been done. In the 80s, there was a boom in construction following the early recessions, you know, the 1980 recession, 1981 through 82 recessions. Mm-hmm. There was a boom in construction for housing, and Reagan opened up the, basically this did the same thing, opened up public lands for increased timber production. And so since then, there have been various things that have happened that have reduced that. A lot of people will remember from the 1990s, the debate over the spotted owl being listed on the endangered species list, mm-hmm. and a judge calling a halt to the logging on public lands. There was more to it than that. A lot of people just wanted to beat up on the owl, but the owl is an indicator species, which means that the environment, the ecosystem was collapsing. Mm-hmm. So, it's declined a lot since then. And so what Trump is doing is kind of revisiting an old something from the Reagan administration, this idea of bringing in more revenue for the U.S. Forest Service through mm-hmm. logging on public lands.
And do you think this, I mean, it's hard to avoid the timing that this happens to be taking place just as Donald Trump is ramping up this trade war against Canada, from where we get a lot of our lumber in the U.S., if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and the move was timed to this recent Canada applied the 25% tariffs to lumber exports. So it kind of felt like a gut reaction on his part. But obviously, I can't tell you what the president is thinking.
Mm-hmm. Well, nobody can tell us what that guy's thinking. Now, to be clear, I should say our national forests are already harvested for lumber, correct? So this is not like he's taking lands that were never used for this before. It's been used for this before. I guess this order merely increases the amount that can be used for that, as I understand it.
Yeah, absolutely. The U.S. Forest Service does open parts of the forest to logging, and a lot of this is done around forest management. Mm-hmm. I don't know if your listeners may know, but there's something like over 100 years of poor forest management on the U.S. Forest Service's mm-hmm. part, because there was this idea that it's the old smoky bear idea that we can prevent forest fires. The minute that a fire starts, we have to put it out. But that ignores the fact that fire is a natural part of the ecosystem, mm-hmm. and it helps clear dry vegetation. It helps kill invasive species that attack trees. And in my recent discussion with Patrick Wright, who's, I'm going to reference California again, is the director of the Forest and Wildfire Resilience Task Force in California. Mm-hmm. The forests have been in many parts of the United States, not just California, have become so dense because of this policy that they're leading to these larger wildfires. Mm-hmm. And so what the U.S. Forest Service is trying to do with the minimal budget that they've been given and understaffing is to go in and manage these forests by removing trees, doing more prescribed burning. Mm-hmm. It's forest management, right? It's their job. So yes, there is money that's made off of that logging, but it's and I have a graph on the article that you referenced, mm-hmm. showing the vast difference between how much was taken out, how many acres were harvested in the 1980s compared to now.
So it's one thing to harvest the forest after burns and so forth versus going in and clear cutting, which I think many environmentalists fear is what could happen here. Do we have a sense yet of what this order will actually mean? Will it lead to more clear cutting of forests?
I mean, that's absolutely the concern. And that's what happened in the 1980s. That's what was happening in Oregon, the Pacific Northwest. And Trump's recent order states that it's, you know, it's part of it is forest management. Mm-hmm. And that he states that it'll, you know, help decrease wildfires and protect wild, all sorts of things that it will not do, because as we've known, that it's not like the fires have disappeared since the 1980s when this clear cutting happened. And unfortunately, logging creates all sorts of environmental issues, not just waste getting into the waterways, but you also have what's called slash that's left over from logging. It's basically the stuff that they can't use, they leave behind, that creates more fuel for wildfires. So the huge concern is that, yes, you are, we're looking at a, what may happen is as just a return to the 1980s, essentially.
And leaving a slash, you said it's called, it's left behind.
Yeah.
And that can help to touch off fires or to make them worse. And at the same time, Matt Sedlar, you published a piece last week at CEPR headlined, "As Wildfires Rage On, Federal Investment in Fire Protection Declines," noting that Elon Musk's Doge chainsaw is cutting jobs at the very agencies we need to prevent wildfires and manage our forests. How can that be squared then with Donald Trump claiming that this, you know, expanding timber will, you know, clear-cutting timber will somehow help avoid massive wildfires with better forest management, even while they're firing, they're laying off the very people who manage our forests and help fight the fires? Can that possibly be, those two things possibly be squared somehow?
Well, not in the direction that they want. I think that the laying off the Forest Service workers, the National Park Service workers, and then putting out this executive order expanding logging, and now we're finding out that they're canceling leases for various offices and visitor centers for national parks across the United States. These all point to this idea of privatization of the public lands, eliminating what we know of as national forests and national parks and opening it up to making it a revenue stream, essentially. Yeah, it leads more towards that and less towards what he's saying is that this is forest management, because the science simply does not support what he's saying. It didn't support it in the 80s when you had researchers and scientists warning against it, and it's definitely not going to support it now.
Speaking of science, can you talk a little bit about the tie between our national forests and their health and the fight against climate change? How does this executive order by Trump threaten that balance as you see it, Matt?
Well, if we remove the forests, it causes all sorts of environmental degradation. And as we know, forests are essential to removing carbon from the atmosphere. If we are removing that tool for removing carbon from the atmosphere, we're simply just letting more carbon out into the atmosphere, increasing global warming, which leads to more changes in the environment. So none of this is great. I mean, you mentioned at the top, the EPA, they're now, the Trump administration is now reconsidering the endangerment finding, which is something that was found, it was 2009, where the EPA said that basically carbon emissions coming from new vehicles are a detriment to public health. And so these are all moves, from what I can tell, these are all moves to generate revenue without and look at how this is affecting long-term sustainable development. It's all short-term gain for long-term losses.
Even if we look at it on those terms, on their terms, that, you know, we must privatize anything that can be privatized because we need to make money from all of these assets that the U.S. owns. Isn't outdoor tourism, national park tourism, so forth, isn't that a huge revenue generator for local and rural communities around the country?
I don't know if I would say it's a huge revenue generator, but it is a revenue generator, especially for small economies in rural counties. And for the federal government, it's probably not a huge generator, but I don't think that they are looking at it as how it affects at a local level. They're looking at it as how it basically affects the bottom line of the federal government. I mean, that's been DOGE's whole mission, right, is to save the government money. And so that's what they're looking at now. But it absolutely will devastate rural economies. It'll devastate the small towns that are near national parks. national forests. You know, tourism this year, who knows how that's gonna go. I myself was planning a vacation to Yosemite sometime in the summer, and now we're, you know, is that going to happen? I don't know. Is that a good idea? But I do think that it's going to have a horrible impact on America's best idea, right? That's what we refer to as our national parks.
Yeah.
This idea of preserving history and the environment of the United States. And instead, we're turning it into a revenue-generating scheme, essentially.
There's also, you suggest, a sort of an ersatz coalition between some on both the right and the left. You know, hunters and fishermen, for example, on the right, environmentalists on the left, who have been critical of efforts to degrade our national parks and forests. Is this sort of thing popular? Overall, among the American people, do we have any sense of that yet?
I wish I had polling numbers on this, but it is absolutely across the spectrum. The idea of the national parks, you know, conservationists are not just people on the left. They're, like you said, hunters and fishers. There are associations out there that, you know, their goal is conservation. And so I do think that this is an idea that is terribly unpopular in many areas mm-hmm. of the country. And you know, we're starting to see pushback. You see all these videos of U.S. Forest Service workers, park rangers who are posting these videos about the effects that it's going to have, not only on, you know, small economies, but also the parks themselves. And, you know, we've seen some of these effects before during one of the government shutdowns. You know, we have lines, really long lines getting into the parks, people vandalizing parks because, you know, there weren't rangers there. And with increased, you know, wildfires, it's going to have even a bigger effect. So I think that when you look at this, isn't so much a partisan issue as this is a issue of the people, conservationists, environmentalists, people who love the outdoors. And again, that's across the spectrum. It's not just people on the left versus this idea that we have to generate revenue from our public land.
Yeah, people, as you mentioned, those government shutdowns, people, all Americans of all stripes, get really mad when the national parks are shut down for any reason, suggesting they really like their national parks. And the notion that they would prefer to visit a national park where all the trees have been cut down, I guess there's plenty of stumps to sit on, but it does not seem to be something that will be particularly popular with the American people. I'm wondering, you know, as we've been reporting, many of Trump's executive orders and actions to implement them have been challenged in court, many of them so far successfully. Have we yet seen challenges to this particular executive order on logging that would essentially privatize and result in, you know, clear cutting of wide swaths of our national forest? Have we seen any challenges yet, or would you expect to see them? And if so, on what legal grounds?
I have not seen any challenges yet. I can pretty much guarantee that there will be. On what grounds? I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, but I do think that organizations like the Sierra Club, I think that they're getting ready. If not, they're already doing, you know, they're already putting things in motion to challenge these. Like you said at the top, a lot of it has to do with procedure and how he's going about doing these things. And I think that seems to be the best plan of attack in any issue that Doge or Trump is undertaking right now, is how is he going about making these changes? And that's a small fix because, as we all know, he can just turn around and do it the proper procedure, take the proper procedure to make these changes. But right now, the best band-aid is to go after the procedure. That's my guess.
And it's my hope. And I say that because there are just so many things going on all at once. So many of the groups and the legal organizations are so overtaxed by you know, all of the challenges that are underway. It's one of the reasons I kind of wanted to bring this one out, because it, you know, came across the radar. It came across everyone's TV screens for about 30 seconds. Oh, Trump orders, you know, massive new, you know, clear cutting of our forests. And then it disappeared with all of the other legal and political nightmares that are underway. So I did kind of want to just put it out there. Yeah, this is going on too. Hey, Matt Sedlar, before I let you go, since you failed to ruin the broadcast, you want to give us a 30-second pitch for your monthly podcast, Sociology Ruins Everything?
Yeah. So it's a podcast that, like you said, just runs once a month. And I take an issue, any issue, and just kind of look at it through a sociological lens. The last episode was on wildfires, which is appropriate to our discussion. Mm-hmm. But I've looked at unaccompanied migrant youth. I've looked at puppetry. I've looked at all sorts of issues, furniture poverty, and just I'll bring on people who are experts on the topic because I can't be an expert on everything, and just let people talk about how these things, how we need to think about them in terms of public problems rather than private issues, which is the sociology theme. So yeah, it's out there on all the podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah. It's called Sociology Ruins Everything. And if you're ever wondering if there were experts in furniture poverty, well, tune in and find out.
There are.
Matt Sedlar, a sociologist and a climate analyst for the Center for Economic and Policy Research. You can find their work at cepr.net and on the Blue Skies and, yes, Twitter at CEPRDC. You can find Matt Sedlar there as well. Matt, really enjoyed talking to you today. Thanks for bringing some light on this important issue. I hope you don't mind if we bother you in the future again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you, Matt. Okay, we got to get out. But Desi Doyen, you're looking at me like you want to say something.
Yes, I'm really glad that you guys brought up outdoor tourism revenue, outdoor recreation revenue, because I think it's really important to remember no one visits a clear-cut forest. Logging permanently destroys a resource for private profit, or at least, you know, for 60, 70 years. Outdoor tourism and recreation, on the other hand, is a sustainable revenue source in perpetuity for local rural economies and communities that are the gateways to these locations. So it's really crucial to balance those out. And this order does not do that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I'm glad you're underscoring that because it is something that is overlooked whenever we're talking about destroying our forests.
Exactly.
Oh, look at all the money we're going to make. Except you talk to people who live in these towns where their tourism is going to be just cut off at the knees along with the trees. Yeah.
It's bad.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much, Desi Doyen. Thanks again to Matt Sedlar. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of our program today, want to hear it again, want to share it with someone you know, love, or hate, you can do that for free at bradblog.com anytime, day or night. That's made possible by those of you who hit a donate button to help us stay on your public airwaves, or just go to bradblog.com/donate. It couldn't be easier. It'll take you 60 seconds. It'll help us continue to do what we try to do every day, whatever that is. Drop me email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, especially Blue Sky, you will find me at the Brad Blog. See you there. Till we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world. You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported thanks to listeners like you who stop by bradblog.com/donate.